just over, well, it gets longer and longer ago now, but just over a century ago, the Wright brothers got the first airplane off the ground. Do you think at that time they could have possibly imagined that someday men would be standing on the moon? If you think over the last century, especially in the last 30 years, in the last 10 years, think about the strides that medical science has made in dealing with human diseases and injuries. And we understand that many, many people would have lost their lives, and they're saved now because of those strides. In economically advanced countries like us, like the United States, and we know we are very spoiled, we take for granted, you know, so many things like the car, the automobile, you know, television on demand to watch whatever we want, the fact that we have electricity, and when we're without it, it seems like this is really bad, you know, for if we don't know what we're going to do. The fact that we can make a reservation today, get on a plane tomorrow, and fly anywhere we want to. Just think about computers and all of the advances. Things have changed a lot. Yet if you consider, in spite of all this scientific wonder, this last century has witnessed the evil of things like Auschwitz, the leaders of, you know, Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, Hussein, we could go down that list, communist totalitarianism. Look at over the last century, but especially the last 50 years, just the rise of terrorism in the name of religion, and the use of technology, you know, as a tool for ungodly rule. Now, if you ask Christians in general, just Christianity in general, they will rightly claim that every person has value and is a special creation of God's. We know that. God has a plan for all mankind. But still, many ask themselves, why do people do such terrible things? You know, why do they commit such heinous crimes? We know that God did not create people evil. We could go back, we won't spend the time today, but we could go back in our Bibles and clearly see that the first human beings initially displayed no evil thoughts. They displayed no evil actions. And we know from reading our Bibles that they lived in harmony with their Creator and each other. We understand, as Dwight mentioned a little bit earlier, we are created. Human beings were made in the image and likeness of God. And if you think about this even a little more, that's the reason that we have the ability to love. That's the reason we have the ability to reason and to feel and to express really some pretty complex emotions. God gave us this incredible ability. But God gave us something else. Well, along with the ability to reason and the capacity to look at facts and come to conclusions, comes the power to choose. Just think about it for a minute. In any single day, every one of us make hundreds of reasoned choices every day. Right? We decide what we're going to wear each day, depending on what the weather or what we're going to be doing that day. We decide what we're going to have for lunch, and we decide which projects are going to get our priority that day. We also decide which thoughts that we're going to consider and which ones we're going to discard. We decide how we are going to deal with our own emotions and what actions that we're going to take in treating others. You see, the important part of this, brethren, is we have to understand that in this way, human beings have the capacity, and we know this, to choose between good and evil. We can choose to control our anger, or we can choose to take revenge on somebody who's made us mad. You see, the issue of choice, brethren, is a pretty complex human activity, but again, freedom of choice explains why human beings can be both good and bad. But I guess one of the basic questions you'd have to ask is why would anyone choose to be bad? You know, why would anyone choose to be evil? Well, for me, we need to remember that we are born with a few inherent instincts. One of them is self-preservation. Consider that. If we didn't have a will to survive as humans, the entire race would have probably died out thousands of years ago. And a part of this self-preservation also tells us that we want to avoid, you know, unpleasant experiences. No one wants to feel any physical pain or any discomfort of being, say, cold or hungry. No one wants to feel emotionally rejected or ever made to feel worthless by others. You see, we want to feel good. Every single one of us in this room has a desire to please our five senses. You see, this instinct for self-preservation, the need for food and shelter, and the desire to please our senses isn't necessarily evil or bad. The key is to understand is how we choose to fulfill those desires that then is either good or bad. For me, as I try to simplify things, because I'm a simple man, I think it boils down to how much we are trying to be selfless. Or you could say, how selfish are we? How much of it is all about me do we have in our lives? And I think we'll see by the end of this message, brethren, that we all struggle with this on a daily basis. Maybe in ways that we haven't ever thought of. But basically, brethren, if you consider this, and we'll go through some specific examples later, selfishness is really at the root of evil things. The title of my sermon simply is, Are You Selfless? And I could end the sermon by saying, no, we aren't. But let's look at reality, okay? Just a second. Because of the intensity of our instinct for self-preservation, and I mentioned earlier our desire to fulfill the senses, each of us in our own way sees ourselves as the, this may be an overstatement, but as the center of the universe. And the more that we succumb to this, to unbridled selfishness, the more that damaging our choices can become. Again, we have to ask ourselves, am I selfless? And we'll look at some obvious examples in modern times in a little while, where evil selfishness wreaked havoc on others. Again, I mentioned some leaders before. I mentioned Saddam Hussein. I just watched a little thing on him here recently, so he's on my mind. But Saddam Hussein, who on a national scale exerted selfishness on others through force, through intimidation, through violence. And we can see that. We see leaders around the world that have done that. What's much, much harder is to come to grips with the selfishness, rather, that lies within each one of us. You see, the less selfless that we are, or the more selfish that we are, the more that we focus on our selfish desires, you see, the less we're able to recognize and even understand our own faults and to experience genuine concern for the welfare of others. I mean genuine concern, something that's just not on the surface, just not shallow. And think about this. Many of the sins that we're caught in are brought on because we have some times this overwhelming urge or desire to please ourselves and our senses. Think about that. We won't turn there. Romans 3:23. It's a scripture many of us can just recite from memory, but it tells us that all have sinned and have fallen short of the glory of God. The solution to the problem, the only solution, the only answer, is God. We only need, brethren, to allow ourselves to tap into that wisdom and apply it to our lives. Turn, if you would, back to 1 Kings 21. I mentioned earlier that later we're going to talk about some specific areas where our self-centered minds often struggle. But before that, I want to look at a classic example in our Bible about selfishness and its evil consequences. And we've been through this story in other messages in the past. But as you turn to 1 Kings 21, we're going to see in this story that selfishness, or lust in this case, brings about terrible results. This, again, this lust for power, this lust for wealth, this lust for what I want, certainly brings all kinds of curses with it. But you remember the story, if we turn here, of Naboth's vineyard, I should say. Now, if you've been around a vineyard or ever had grapes or known anyone, you know that it takes a long time to get a vineyard going. It takes years. In fact, some vineyards we know have been around for generations. And some are just because of that, and the care are producing just this amazing stock. But if you talk to a vine dresser, you know he'll tell you it takes a lot of work. It takes constant work. It takes constant diligence over really a long period of time to produce the finest grapes for the finest wines. And as we jump into the story here, we're going to see that Naboth apparently had a vineyard like that. Verse 1 of 1 Kings 21. It says, "Now it came to pass after these things, Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard, which was in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria." So apparently it was right up next to the palace grounds. There are some commentaries that will tell you that it was right up against the palace walls. Others feel it was just next to the king's property itself. It doesn't really matter. What we'll see here is that Ahab wanted that piece of property. And so verse 2, Ahab spoke to Naboth saying, "Give me your vineyard that I might have it for my garden of herbs." Basically a garden, just a vegetable garden. So we can infer here that he was going to destroy this vineyard. You know, he's in his mind thinking, I'm going to plant some tomatoes, some corn, some beans, whatever. He wants this property to plant this garden of herbs. Again, so back up a minute. Now consider, he's talking to Naboth, who's probably, his father probably lived, maybe was born on the property, and had worked it for generations. Who knows? Maybe we'll go back further than that. Maybe his grandfather was born and worked the property. Who knows how many generations back? But in Naboth's mind, there's no way he's going to allow it to be plowed under. There's no way he's going to give up this beautiful piece of landscape and manicured property who someone's going to tear down and plant tomatoes. Right, to Naboth, it just doesn't seem right. You know, he's thinking to himself, this is my family's heritage. And Naboth said, we know he's going to say, look, I'll pay you for it. I'll give you money. I'll trade you another piece of land somewhere else for it. And if we step back a moment, it certainly wasn't an illogical request on Ahab's part. Have you had the ability to see a piece of property and go ask, I really like this house, I really like this plot, would you consider selling it? There's nothing wrong with that. Again, verse 3, it says, Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid it that I should give my the inheritance of my fathers unto you. He's saying, there's not a chance. I'm giving you my inheritance. Verse 4, Ahab came into his house heavy and displeased because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. For he said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And he laid him down on his bed and turned away his face and would eat no bread. So he is pouting. Can you imagine him, his bottom lip stuck out? You know, he's pouting, right? I can call him a big baby. So it seems to me that's what it boils down to. But as we go on in the story, notice the slyness of his wife. Verse 5. But Jezebel, his wife, came in and said to him, why is your spirit so sad that you eat no bread? And he said to her, because I spoke unto Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else if it pleases you, I will give you another vineyard for it. And he answered, again, I can just picture this, his bottom lip stuck out, I will not give you my vineyard. Verse 7, and Jezebel, his wife, said to him, Do you not govern the kingdom of Israel? Aren't you the king? She's saying, you're the king. Don't you know how to handle this situation? And she said, you're just sitting there and you're moping. She says, get up, right? Arise, eat bread, and let your heart be merry. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. So as you can see, my earlier point, lust breeds selfishness, and selfishness, we could say, on the other hand, you know, breeds lust. Lying and stealing, and in this case, we're going to see, eventually murder, are the end results. Verse 8, and so she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal and sent the letters to the elders and the nobles that were in the city, in this city, dwelling with Naboth. Now, do you think for a minute that these elders were fooled? Do you think that they thought that these letters were actually written by Ahab? You know, we'll see here in the story that there's not a chance they thought that. They knew exactly who these were coming from. Right, they knew exactly who wanted this done. They knew if they didn't carry it out, that it wasn't going to be good for them because their necks would be on the chopping block. Next, because that kind of lust, that kind of desire for power, you know, that kind of corruption doesn't care who it affects. Basically, she's saying in a veiled threat, if you do not carry out what I want done, I'll kill you, and someone else will do it. So either take the money for doing it, or get out of the way. Verse 9, it says, and she wrote in the letter, saying, proclaim a fast. So, you remember the story, they had this big party, And they were saying what a great, great guy Naboth is. But then two people were supposed to stand up and say that, well, he's not such a good guy. We heard him curse God and the king. And for that, he should be stoned. Here's what he said. And whatever he says they lied about was, what we could see, was so inflaming that everyone hauled Naboth out, and he was stoned. He was killed. Verse 11, and the men of the city, even the elders and the nobles who were the inhabitants in the city, did as Jezebel said to them. So they were complicit in this. They were participants in the murder, probably because they feared Jezebel too much to not do it. Right, as it was written in the letters that she had sent to them. So in verse 12, we see this happen. In verse 12, they proclaim the fast, the two came and lied about him, they drug him out to kill him. But drop down to verse 15. It says in verse 15, and it came to pass when Jezebel heard that Naboth was stoned. Now, I guess, let's go back up to verse 14. Again, were they fooled? Did they think that Ahab was the one sending these letters? Again, not a chance. Verse 14. These elders and these nobles, verse 14, they sent to Jezebel, they knew who wrote the letters, saying, Naboth is stoned and is dead. They knew who sent those letters, even if it had Ahab's name on it, but they feared her. They feared her reputation. They feared her lust. They feared her selfishness. And we see that lying and stealing eventually ended in murder. And then we could read more about Jezebel later. We know she was not a good person, but she was evil through and through. She had no conscience or problems with, in this case, killing this completely innocent man to show who was in charge, to get what she wanted. And so verse 15, and it came to pass when Jezebel heard that Naboth was stoned and was dead, that Jezebel said to Ahab, arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money. For Naboth is not alive, he's dead. Do you think Ahab didn't know what happened? He knew that Naboth didn't just suddenly drop dead of a heart attack or something. But he allowed her to work this scheme. And so, obviously, therefore, he's just as guilty. Verse 16, and it came to pass when Ahab heard that Naboth was stoned, that he pulled in his bottom lip. He stopped pouting. And he arose up to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. Again, as if somehow he was an innocent party, which we know, of course, he was not. That's just one story in our Bible that we can look at that it reminds us to guard against the lust and that kind of selfishness that would lead to lying and stealing or specifically, more, it could be murder. I came across a saying that President Woodrow Wilson said, and I like this. He said, if you think about what you ought to do for other people, your character will take care of itself. Let's say that again. If you think about, so it's again not putting yourself first, if you think about what you ought to do for other people, your character will take care of itself. It makes a lot of sense to me. If I were to interview each of you and ask you what you would say about a person who is wrapped up in their own selfish life, you know, I would ask you, well, how does that type of person, how do they respond to others? I say, well, I know a person like that now. Well, sometimes they're just self-centered, they're thoughtless. Sometimes they're just too busy to listen. Or they're too busy to lend someone a helping hand or give support. You might say, yeah, and sometimes they're just really insensitive. They can be mean, they can be cruel. And they're really unthankful. Do those descriptors sound like what is becoming the typical mentality of the world we live in? Of our society? Turn back, if you will, to 2 Timothy. We can read about this in 2 Timothy.
Mm-hmm.
2 Timothy, let's start in verse chapter 3. We'll read verses 1 through 4. I've said before that I believe, and it was alluded to in our opening prayer, that times are bad. It tells us here, things are going to get worse. It says, but know this, 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will become lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control. He goes on to say they'll become brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. He says, from such, turn away. Just look around. You know, we only see so much of what's out there because the news only reports on so much. And I'm glad that we don't know all of the things going on out there. But the things that gangs do, you know, the terrorists, the atrocity that they commit without remorse, without feeling. There's no emotional response. There's no caring. But, brethren, people of character are very different. Consider this, a person who really cares, I mean who really cares, like God expects us to, that person who really cares feels an emotional response to both the pain and the joy of others. Person who really cares feels an emotional response to not only the good, but the bad that other people are experiencing. And you and I, who have been called by God, we are called by God to think, brethren, and to live as caring people. Because we are children of a loving, caring Father. Turn back to Colossians 2. It references this here in Colossians 2. We'll read, Colossians 3, verses 12 through 13. We are called by God, as it mentions here in Colossians 3, we are the elect of God. Colossians 3, verses 12 and 13. Again, speaking directly to us. Therefore, as the elect of God, that's you and I, brethren, holy and beloved. He's very clear here, telling us what to do. He says, put on tender mercies. Put on kindness, humility. Put on meekness. Put on long-suffering, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, you also must be. We have a choice. If we want to be forgiven by God, if we still hold a grudge, if we still haven't forgiven someone, we have to. Again, he says at the end of verse 13, it says, but above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. I look back at my life at times where I didn't put on those things that was described in Colossians. And it pained me, you know, to think that my human nature is sometimes something that I haven't controlled, or probably still don't at times. And we have to understand our nature, because we know that human nature is self-centered, basically, rather than God-centered. You can write down Romans 8:7. It tells us there, because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. Again, the self-centeredness that I'm talking about today can really blind us to the causes and the effects of our own words and actions. Make us not care or not even consider how they impact others. But what it also does, can do, and does, is it can also block our sensitivities to the pain that we probably don't mean to, but we inflict on others. Or maybe we need to with our sharp tongue. But it blocks us to the blocks our sensitivities to the pain that we inflict on others. Turn back just a little bit to Galatians. You know, Scripture expresses, brethren, the enormous scope of truly abusive thoughts and actions. And we'll just look at one here, one set of Scriptures for today. But Galatians 5, verses 19 through 21. Again, as we talk about our self-centered human nature, it describes it here. Well, the works of the flesh, that's when our human nature takes charge and we don't yield to God's Spirit. The works of the flesh, it says, are evident. They're very clear. Which are? And he gives us a list. Adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, and it keeps going, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I told you a time in the past, that those who practice such things, this last part's pretty serious, those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. Brother, the painful consequences of these abuses that we just read about here may be physical, they may be mental. The consequences may be spiritual and or emotional. And whether we have abused others, sometimes repeating what has been done to us, because that's all we know. Or if we've been a victim of abuse, it's possible that our whole thought process may hold us in bondage to this learned, repetitive behavior and potentially these unresolved emotional feelings that we suffer. But we have to understand, brethren, as we dig down into this, that our thoughts and our emotions produce our actions. Our thoughts and our emotions produce our actions. Let me explain that a bit. We mentioned already that thoughts and feelings play this important role in our lives. And as our feelings connect with our thoughts, then emotions are formed. We know that God, we mentioned it earlier, God created us with emotions so that our lives could be enriched. Now consider, he could have just developed us without emotions. We could be intelligent, we could be calculating, insensitive machines. But wouldn't life be just exceedingly dull? We know that's not how it happened. Instead, God has given us this truly, really astonishing capacity for emotion. And if you think about this, in seemingly infinite combinations, in seemingly infinite combinations of types of emotions and intensities. And unfortunately, some people feel that they view emotions and feelings in negative terms. And the people that I worked with for so long, the adults with disabilities, so many times, someone would be mad or sad or something, and I would hear staff say, "Oh, don't be mad. Don't be sad. You shouldn't be mad about that." And I talk to them on the side and say, "Don't say that, because we're all entitled to our emotions." With the people I worked with, what our job was is to help them learn how to express their emotion in an appropriate way, not to tell them, "You shouldn't feel mad, you shouldn't feel sad." That's not how God created us. But as a result, if we have those feelings, there are times in our lives that we may attempt to ignore some of our emotions and the effects that they're really having on our lives. I read an article, it's been a while back, I tried to find it, all of it, but I had written down some notes from it. But it's talking about science trying to begin to understand the emotional component of the mind. And you can read the whole article, there's a lot of big words in there, but they really can't. But it said in the quote, it said, "Only in recent years has there emerged a scientific model of the emotional mind," I question that, scientific model, "that explains how so much of what we do can be emotionally driven. It says how we can be so reasonable at one moment and so irrational the next, and in the sense in which the emotions have their own reason and their own logic." Science has tried to explain a lot of things, and that's one that they just have not been able to, likely will not, because God gave us that gift. But in Proverbs 23, verse 7, you can write down, and we're going to read here in Proverbs 23, this is the insightful wisdom of Solomon. He reminds us that in Proverbs 23, verse 7. He says, As a man or woman, as he thinks in his heart, so is he. As he thinks in his heart, so is he. So, again, we remind ourselves, hopefully, often, that getting close to God, seeking godly wisdom, is paramount. You can write down Proverbs 19, verse 8. It says, "He who gets wisdom loves his own soul, and he who keeps understanding will find good." But then what it's telling us here is that the process of emotional healing requires us to follow God's instructions about how to manage our emotions, not to deny them, how to manage them, how to address them, how to deal with them. Let's apply some of this to some areas, some specific areas, where we can see, if we're honest, how our selfishness could cause, or has caused, or at least has exacerbated a problem. Again, I like black and white. The first one, to me, is obvious. The first area we'll talk about is just relationships. I've said to you before in messages, if you consider it, everything we do is about relationships. Look at the Ten Commandments. First four about our relationship with God, the last six about our relationship with others. But when we consider relationships as a whole, consider this. Many a relationship has been squandered because of selfishness. I can see that in my life. You know, whether it's work or church, whether it's home, wherever, golf course, we've all had to deal with relationship problems. I think back, and I think it's probably the same for all of us, maybe it's only me, sometimes I think we're overwhelmed by just how selfish that person is. We're overwhelmed by just how self-centered they are, because it clashes with my own self-centeredness. And maybe we get put out because someone doesn't see it my way. Or someone doesn't even acknowledge my stance or my ideas as much as I think they should. I'm being a little overboard here, but bear with me. What about those times when someone makes a decision that we would not have made and we get disgusted with it? Why? Because I didn't get what I wanted. If we're honest, maybe their decision inconvenienced me and messed up the plans I had. Maybe my plans would have messed up their plans, would have inconvenienced them. Think about it, brethren. Again, relationships. We need to remember that we are to follow Christ's example about how he treated others. To follow it at all times. To follow it in all situations. And we need to learn to appreciate people's differing talents, people's differing gifts. I think back again, talking about the participants that I worked with, one of the things that I was humbled by every day, first of all, was their genuine love for each other, their humility. But I was struck every day, and I sometimes had to kind of squash it, by their complete selflessness. You think, why would you squash that? It's because they see you didn't bring a very good lunch today, so they give you theirs, and they don't have anything to eat. Or you see them walking to the bus without shoes. Hey, where are your shoes? Billy's had holes in them. I gave him mine. It's snowing out. I'll be fine. Let's look at Hebrews 12, verse 14. I got to see that every day, the selflessness. I miss that. I think about going back and visiting sometime. It'd be good to see those guys. But Hebrews 12, verse 14, this is again a very direct statement. Hebrews 12, verse 14. As we think about relationship problems that we've had, disagreements that we've had, things that hard feelings we might still hang on to or harbor, it says very clear, Job, or whoever, put your name in here, pursue peace with everyone. Not who we want to. God says, pursue peace with everyone and holiness, for without it, no one will see the Lord. And these are pretty heavy scriptures, and it's not my interpretation of them. That's what the Bible says. What about Matthew 5? As we talk about, again, about relationships. Matthew 5, we'll read verses 43 through 48. Again, if you have a red letter Bible, we can see Christ speaking these words. Matthew 5, verse 43, it says, you have heard it, that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But, verse 44, I say to you, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. Oh, that's the first thing that comes to my mind. It's supposed to be, but I'm not quite there yet. Hate your enemy, he says, but I tell you, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. Verse 45, so that you may be like your Father in heaven, since he causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Verse 46, for if you love those who love you, he's saying, so what? What reward do you have? Even the tax collectors do the same, don't they? And verse 27, and if you only greet your brothers, what more do you do? That's what everybody does. Even the Gentiles do the same, don't they? And again, it tells us, this is our goal. This is something we have to pray for every day and strive for. It says, so then be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Here's another area. What about serving others? We've heard the term servant leadership, but brethren, true servant leadership goes against selfishness. You see, to be a true servant leader, which we understand that we're all to be, there are several characteristics we have to develop. Things like, a true attitude of humility, the ability and the willingness, and I think that's the key here, the willingness to truly listen to others, not just the words, but pay attention to their tone, to their body language, to the emphasis they put on words. Really listen, emphatic listening. We have to develop things like an ability to empathize with the needs of others. Not somewhere in the back of our minds say, well, they got what they deserved. Maybe I'm the only one who's ever thought that. We have to develop a commitment to seeing that the needs of others are truly met whenever possible. And so ask yourself, and I as I'm doing to myself, do I have those qualities? Am I able to put others' feelings ahead of my own? You see, selfishness, brethren, prohibits us from being God-like in our actions. And again, I'm going to guess that each of us struggles with this at times. You know, the urge to take care of me, it's a very powerful one, and it shows itself many times during the course of the day in each of us, and that's just a fact. But recognizing it for what it is crucial for us all if we want to overcome it. Mark 10, 4, verse 45. We really want to grow in the way that Christ expects us to. And he talks about us being serving others and the example that we're set for us. But verse 45, it just reminds us of Mark 10. It says, for even the Son of Man, Jesus Christ, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. A gentleman named Paul Moody said this, and I like this. He said, the measure of a man is not the number of his servants, but the number of people whom he serves. Peter Drucker said, no leader is worth his salt who won't set up the chairs. What about basic choices? You think about it again. We make countless ones each day. We talked about it a little bit. But over the next week or so, to help focus on this, I'm going to ask you to do this. With every choice you make, okay, over the next week or so, with every choice you make, and you're going to make many of them, ask yourself what your motive for that decision is. Now, it's true, in many cases, the answer is going to be, just because I want to, isn't a bad thing. It isn't necessarily a bad thing. I want strawberry today instead of green. Or whatever. It isn't necessarily a bad thing. It can be, of course, but decisions based upon just because that's what I want to do not have to be negative. What I think you'll see, as I have, as I've done this exercise, is that as humans, again, we are selfish beings. And you're going to see as you consider these things that many of the irritations that you endure are a result of someone's selfishness clashing with your own. How rude is that? Again, understand this, brethren. This is important. Every choice that we make takes us either closer or farther away from something. You see, and all too often, that something that we are moving away from is God. And we could spend a lot of time, if we wanted, talking about the consequences. You know, the obvious consequence we know for us choosing to sin is death. Now, the choice to eat foods that are bad for you, or even just overeating, you know, can cause health problems. See, every choice we make causes something to happen. We don't live in a vacuum. And the good news is, though, is God has given us the tools to make wise choices in all matters. The question is, for me, why do I not always use those tools? Isaiah 30, verse 21, you can write it down. But it's a short phrase, but very profound. It says, "You will hear a word spoken behind you saying, 'This is the correct way. Walk in it.'" You know, when you say, "I can do this or this," and you hear this little voice, you might talk to yourself, "I know I should do this, but I'm not going to." We talk ourselves out of doing the right thing at times. What about another area? They all overlap a little bit, but what about pride? What about pride? Because that can be pretty painful. Have you ever had your pride hurt? Sure you have. I have too, and one of my character flaws when my pride gets hurt is it makes me mad. How dare they? You see, pride in us can literally be a killer. But again, we have to understand that self-preservation, that self-absorbed side of us thinks, whatever, we're pretty smart, we're pretty talented, we're pretty knowledgeable, we're pretty humble. Makes us think we're unflappable, you name it. And then when someone says or does something that might not see us or show us in such a favorable light, it hurts. Has it ever happened to you? Have you ever felt put down or slighted? Sure, yeah. Have you ever slighted someone else or put them down? It's likely that you have. I'll spend the rest of this time, brethren, we have looking at some specific areas that might trip people up and understand that. Again, when we dig into the cause, you know, when we peel back all the layers of the onion, we can see that selfishness or me is the heart of the issue. What about, here's an easy one, we talked about it earlier, what about adultery, you know, fornication? What's the purpose? Is it the thrill? Is it the emotional and or physical rush you feel? Or is it about putting someone else's feelings ahead of your own? No. It's about indulging the senses. It's about you. About anger. mentioned earlier, anger isn't necessarily a bad emotion. There are times, again, that our anger might be justified. But I believe every one of us, brethren, if we are honest, it usually comes back to me. Someone slighted me, or said something, or did something I didn't like. And we'll find, I think, as we consider this, that anger, brethren, is often based on selfishness. Or just even something that, like attitude. See, I have an attitude. But what I have to understand, because you have attitudes as well, that our attitude is controlled by our thoughts. My attitude is controlled by my thoughts. I can convince myself in the morning when I get up that I'm either going to have a good day or a bad day. And those decisions are all too often based upon my particular outlook. If I have something to do that I don't want to do, or I have to go deal with someone else who was exhibiting probably some selfish behavior, I can have a poor attitude. And we know this, but I have complete control, so do you, over your attitude. No one can make you do anything. You know, Flip Wilson, those of you old enough, remember, used to say, the devil made me do it. I've known spouses that have said, you caused me to do this. No, we can't cause anyone. No one can cause me to do anything. I have complete control over this. I alone control my attitude. And all too often, in my life, my own selfishness, my own self-centeredness has controlled that outcome. We can talk about drug abuse. It's kind of in there. It's an easy one. Why do people take illicit drugs? To feel good. I've had friends, why do you do it? Why do you get this rush? Or it helps me escape. We could lump alcoholism into that too. People want to do it because it makes me feel good. And I want to deal with reality, at least for a time. Again, it's all about me. What else? What about gossip? What purpose does gossip serve? If we're honest, we think about it. At times it's to make ourselves look better. And there are times that we just want to know what's going on. And then we have to ask ourselves, is it our business? No, but I like to know the scoop. Because you know what? Well, I like to know this. Gossip often is a self-serving thing. I have lust written down specifically. It go back to the adultery and fornication. You know, if it's toward a person, but what about the lust that we understand from our Bible for that new car, that new boat, you know, that new shiny four-wheeler, or those clothes, or food, you name it. Again, bear with me here, but it's all about me. It's all about, I want it. It feels good, it tastes good, it makes me feel good. It's all about me. How about lying? I used to think when I was young I was really good at it. From the deserved beatings I took, I wasn't very, obviously very good at it. But what purpose does it serve? In many cases, I was just trying to get out of trouble. This is about me. Or is this trying to look good? Which is about me. Or to get someone else to just leave us alone. isn't about me. Serves no purpose, Brendan. You see, it serves no purpose other than selfishness. Relationships we talked about, could talk specifically about divorce. Many, many times, it can be traced back to one or the both parties' selfishness and their unwillingness to change their ways. Not always. But we could go through, and I know several people, countless incidents of divorce where they see it's true. It's all about me. In many cases, the person was mean, they were disrespectful, they were spending too much money, they were having affairs, they were arguing, or whatever. But they can see it's all about me. We'll look at one more. Financial difficulties. Financial difficulties are not always the result of selfishness. But if you bear with me, you're going to see, I think this is often the case. Many, many people have declared bankruptcy over the years for legitimate reasons. Others have declared bankruptcy over the years simply because they just continued to live far beyond their means, and they had to keep getting stuff to make them feel good. Think about it. People spend their hard-earned money sometimes on bad things that they can't afford. On booze, on drugs, on tobacco, whatever, entertainment. The list could go on and on. Instead of being responsible and using their heads and living wisely. Again, it is indulgence in a lot of cases, right? And it's about me. We could go on and on. You guys have your own ideas and suggestions and good examples of ways that our own selfishness, our own self-centered ways of thinking have brought on or do bring on hardships in our lives. What I want to do again today is just remind us of this and hope that we all realize that that is not God's way. But it's the opposite of God's way. Now, we first, brethren, each of us need to realize and admit just how often we get in our own way. How often that we cause our own troubles. See, we have to realize that we do live in the me point of view and learn to change that way of thinking. And it's not easy, because that's not how we were born. We're born with this inborn need for self-preservation. But as with most things, the trick is balance. The trick is balance. The ability, brethren, to balance our needs, not our wants, but to balance our needs with the needs of others. And see, that requires a whole new approach to how we think and how we treat others. Are you up to that task? You see, the world that we live in, brethren, is an incredible world with advances all around us that our parents, in some cases, certainly our grandparents, could never have fathomed. And we are so blessed to live in the country we do. And there's so many good things that we do need to be grateful for. And unfortunately, so many bad things, so many evil things that we need to pray that God protects us from. And you might say, well, this is another Christian living sermon, which I understand is my tendency to give. And again, I believe prophecy is important. And we'll talk about it occasionally. But the important thing to remember is, no matter what I think is going to happen, because we don't know for sure, no matter what I think is going to happen or when it will start, the reality is no man yet knows. But in my mind, the only thing that I do have control over is to whether or not I'm following God's instruction to live my life in the way that He expects us. And being more selfless is part of that requirement for all of us. I'll have you write down a couple more scriptures here as we start to wrap up. Philippians 2, verse 3, it tells us, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves." You can also write down James 3, verse 16. It tells us, "For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice." And so I ask the question, will you join me, brethren? Are you ready to put your self-centered inner self to the side and start to begin to act more and more like your Creator, again, in whose image He created us? It's not going to be easy. It's going to be a tough journey, but we're here now. And now's the time to start. You see, brethren, we alone make the choice between good and evil. Are you ready to join me to make that big leap from selfishness to selflessness?